You're listening to Modern Infrastructure, the official podcast of TechTarget's Modern Infrastructure e-zine. To read the latest issue, visit searchdatacenter.com/modern-infrastructure.
Hi, and welcome to the Modern Infrastructure Podcast. I'm Christine Signoli, Managing Editor of Modern Infrastructure.
And I'm Alex Barrett, Editor-in-Chief.
So, Alex, we are wrapping up our July-August issue, and we don't have themed issues per se, but we did end up with a couple of sort of interesting insights into the VMworld, upcoming VMworld show in this issue. And so our issue will come out in July, and the big VMworld show is at the end of August in San Francisco again this year. And this is always an interesting chance, sort of a big annual IT event. And a lot of what VMware is doing now is touching a lot of different segments of IT. So we have a couple of looks at what VMware is up to. And we had one of our in-house writers, Nick Martin, who's the editor of Search Server Virtualization, write a piece for us about VMworld specifically, and it's previewing the show. What did you think?
Yeah, well, it's not really previewing the show in the sense of, you know, here's what they're going to announce, but it's posing a question of, you know, what's the company up to? And, you know, at a high level, his point is that for it to continue to be successful, it needs to branch out into adjacent segments, and that might ruffle the feathers of some of its core, VMware fan base. And it's been doing this for years with so many different acquisitions and products. But you know, when people go to VMworld this year, they might really find themselves faced with content and presentations that really are very different from their day-to-day. But nevertheless, that's what the company needs to do to survive, just because there's so many incursions on the core, you know, enterprise IT space right now. Not least of which is, of course, Amazon, which I wrote about as well. And they over the summer they released a management plugin for vCenter. This whole idea of managing, you know, a hybrid cloud, and under the surface it's a little bit hokey. It's pretty limited in its capabilities, or maybe hokey's not the right word, but it's you know, it's not like a deep integration.
Sort of window dressing on their part, you think?
But whatever the case, you know, they're definitely barking up the right tree, because the people that I talk to, you know, they really do want to use both. It's not just, you know, I'm an all VMware shop or I'm an all AWS shop. There's a case to be made for both, and the, you know, VMware-based clouds haven't really materialized, or at least they haven't. There are some that are out there, but they're not necessarily taking off. And so people really do want to use that combination, and there's some interesting companies out there that are making valid attempts at bridging those two worlds. So I talked to one guy who was using stuff from Revelo to, you know, production was in-house on-prem on VMware, but test and dev was in AWS, and that's not new in and of itself, but it was what Revelo did was make it so that the networking was, you know, tit for tat, the same in the production and AWS environments. So that was pretty cool. So, yeah, we'll be curious to see what VMware has to say about that issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Nick mentioned in his article that I think he had talked to Bob Plankers, who said, well, VMware has their sort of model right now. They do really have an on-premises private cloud bias. So, yeah, but they clearly want to be going into all these other areas. So what's their cloud play going to be? Then we're also hearing about Project Marvin. We're sort of hearing rumors that VMware is coming out with the hardware as sort of a converged product, and that will be announced at VMworld. So, yeah, I'm really interested to see what we hear about their cloud play.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on who you ask, right? Mm-hmm. Some people think that they will come out with converged hardware. Some people think the DMC will come out with converged hardware. Some people think that they'll just come out with a software stack that could, you know, more gracefully create a converged hardware platform than just standard ESX. Who knows?
Yeah, it's
Marvin. It feels
Marvin,
like there's something.
Right?
I could, you know, I picture like a Looney Tunes Marvin Martian.
So the other, actually, during one of our planning meetings for VMworld, we talked about Marvin, and yeah, the theory we all came up with collectively was that this is alien to VMworld.
So for VMware, yeah,
for VMware, right? Marvin is alien. Marvin is a Martian. It's alien to them. Right. That's as far as we got with the code name. But, you know.
We'll find out soon enough,
I know.
I guess.
All will be revealed. So.
Right.
And I'll be at the show and tweeting, you know, from our account, which is at Modern Infra. So we'll be tweeting, and we're going to be covering it with videos and all kinds of stories. And a little bit, we're thinking of a little bit of sort of explainers, you know, for people when... You know, because some of the things VMware announces could very well be sort of foreign to virtualization administrators or just really out of their scope. So hoping to cover some of those, you know, new products or new features, try to give a little bit of a translation for our readers of mm-hmm. what is happening. What exactly is this? What would you actually use this for? So, yeah.
Well, you'll have to keep me up to date because I myself will not be there for the first time, I think, in 8 years.
Wow.
This is my first time I'm not going to VMworld because I will be on vacation in Europe, which I bring this up not because I'm not excited, although I am, but I bring this up because it ties into the feature story that I wrote for the issue on Cloud versus the World, which looks at the issue of using cloud if you have... You know, an international footprint, which most companies do, or many, at least many of them, and explores that the paradox between, you know, the elastic, infinite, dynamic, scalable cloud resource, and the, you know, grounded in reality, terrestrial world with its geopolitical boundaries and safe harbor laws and speed of light latency issues, and how do you reconcile those two very different realities? And you know, I mean, it's obviously an evolving topic, and it's still really early days, especially outside of the U.S. But right now, you know, the long and the short of it is that there's a big disconnect between those two, and if you want to use cloud resources overseas. And you're regulated in any meaningful way, and the EU, you know, will regulate you if you have customer data. It's not a slam dunk at this point. So yeah, it'll definitely. I'm sure that things will evolve over time, but right now it's still really murky and not fully baked.
Mm-hmm. And providers are not helping necessarily. You know, you're not necessarily able to go to your provider for kind of guidance on this stuff. Or...
I think a lot of them try to, but there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of confusion around what the laws are, what constitutes personal data. Depends on what geography you're talking about. And then there's also the, you know, the elephant in the room of government spying, the NSA, Edward Snowden, all that. And who knows what, who's doing what for real. Yeah. So... That casts a pall on a lot of ambitions as well. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, it's good for me because as a journalist, you're always looking for things that are changing and things that are
things
complex.
That are murky. Yeah. Yes, I know. There's always so much to explore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the article. It's a little bit different from some of our other cloud stories of recently. It's just. Cloud is so non-physical. It's great. I really liked realizing, well, wait a minute, cloud is totally physical. Obviously, the data is somewhere.
Yeah.
And where it is.
It's not just magic.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yes. We like to think of it like magic.
And then we also caught up with Steve Bigelow, the senior writer within our group here, who wrote about data center densities and about the crazy stuff that's going on in terms of, cores... multiplying and form factors collapsing or shrinking and just how much processing power you can stuff in a data center today we had a little conversation the other day with him. So Steve, thanks for joining me today, and I enjoyed your article, Data Centers Dense and Getting Denser.
Thanks, Alex.
And, you know, you really ran through a whole long list of technologies that have changed over the past decade or thereabouts. And was there any one in particular that stuck out?
Well, Alex, you know me. I'm a hardware guy from way back when, and I like processors the best. I think some of the most impressive advances have been just in microprocessor design and how the capabilities have evolved, the number of cores just proliferating. I mean, back in the day, it used to be take one core, put as many features and functions on it as you can, and run it at the as fast as you possibly can get it. And that worked just fine, but it generated a lot of heat, it used a lot of energy, and as data centers got bigger and started adding more and more servers, that became a very expensive proposition. So what designers started to realize, especially as we got into the era of smartphones and tablets, is that sometimes less is more, and you can get great computing performance without having to really focus on a processor's performance. So capabilities are good, functionality is good, but you don't have to run it at top speed to get good performance out of it. Scale back the clock frequency a little bit, and scale up the number of cores and distribute the workload amongst multiple cores. And we're seeing that now in pretty much every mainstream processor, and you get a lot more efficiency out mm-hmm. of it that way. And we see that in processors like Intel's Atom. We see that in a lot of ARM variants. And the server processor manufacturers are really catching on. The server class or enterprise class processors like Intel's Xeon E7 family, they're really beginning to embrace some of that philosophy and scale the clock speed back, but increase the number of cores. I mean, some of the models, later models, we're seeing 15 cores on. And I think those densities will only go up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 15 cores, that's a funny number. But then conversely, so you mentioned less is more. Conversely, you find that gigabit Ethernet is really has not been displaced as far as the leadership in the data center, and that the higher speed 40, 100 gigabit Ethernet hasn't really taken off. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, Alex. Really, gigabit Ethernet is the standard these days. And we find it's used broadly on servers. It's used on switches. I mean, what's great about gigabit Ethernet is that it's a very inexpensive, very convenient way to get servers onto the network. Now, let me be clear. Some of those faster standards, the 10 gigi, the 40 gigi, the 100 gigi, we're seeing adoption there. So it's not like the industry has just overlooked those faster speeds. But each time you step up the speed, you need a new type of network interface, you need new cabling, you need new switching infrastructure, and all of that costs money, a lot of money. So what we're finding is that those faster standards are really being adopted in the backbone architecture. For instance, if you're trying to group clusters of servers together, you'll see faster speeds. If you're connecting storage arrays that you want to keep in replication, mm-hmm. you can use faster Ethernet there. But as far as bringing those speeds to the individual servers in the enterprise, you're really sticking with gigabit Ethernet. And what happens there, it's not just a matter of cost and the disruptive nature of an upgrade. It's a question of redundancy, resilience, because the thing you have to think about with servers is you're running more workloads on fewer hardware platforms, so you're getting more and more dependent on fewer and fewer pieces of hardware. And any time that you can eliminate a single point of failure, that's good for your enterprise. So it might be very appealing to think about replacing gigabit Ethernet with 10 gigabit Ethernet, but now you've got a server running 10, 15, 20, 30 workloads, and if you lose connectivity to that server, you lose access to all of those workloads, and that's just a vulnerability that an enterprise doesn't want. So instead of using faster Ethernet, what organizations are opting for is to use redundancy, bring in multiple Ethernet ports, maybe a quad port NIC or two quad port NICs, mm-hmm. and you can do a bunch of things with that. You can trunk the extra ports together, so you can aggregate your bandwidth for applications that need more bandwidth. And you can also take advantage of redundancy. So if one of those ports, multiple ports, should fail, you can always fail over to other working ports, and you may lose a little performance, but you can still get the connectivity that server needs to keep your business running. So that's been a very important thing there. So I think sticking with gigabit Ethernet, especially for the foreseeable future, that's what's going to get you the resiliency and the throughput that you're looking for.
So more is more.
Well, right.
The other thing that you said, and you're talking about heat and how that's rarely a problem in today's data center. And that surprised me just because, you know, I remember back in the day covering blade servers, and that was the big point of discussion is how are we going to cool these damn things? And so what happened? You know, to who do we have this happy state of affairs?
Well, it's a sort of a convergence of circumstances, Alex. Multiple unrelated things sort of all came together in our favor. And if you really want to congratulate any one element for that push, it's really the cost of energy. Back in the day, you had relatively little computing power. Cooling it, powering it was not a big part of your operating expense. But as you add computing resources to your enterprise and you're pushing the components, dissipating a lot of heat, using a lot of energy, that really, I mean, companies stopped and looked at their energy bills and say, whoa, we can't be paying this kind of money. And cooling and the effects of cooling on the enterprise really come down to three different things. Hardware utilization is one of the biggest issues. Making better use of what you've got. And we're seeing the servers with a lot of cores, a lot of memory, and yet they're still using the same amount of energy or less that previous generations of servers used. So you're getting a lot more effective use of power for the number of servers that you're actually using. And then there's the influence of virtualization. So not only do you have a lot more resources available for the same amount of energy, but you can use all those resources with virtualization. So now your servers can do a lot more work for you. Yet keep the server count down. So you have less pieces of equipment in your data center generating heat to begin with. That's first. The second is the facilities implications. So when you have a big space with a lot of equipment that you have to keep cool, you're challenged with these big computer room air conditioners, these massive industrial size cooling units to try to keep the entire volume of your data center cool, and that's a very expensive proposition. So when you drop the hardware count, you drop the amount of space that those servers take up. So now you have to cool a lot less volume, and that opens up a lot of very effective potential for you in terms of your containment. And it's not just hot aisle, cold aisle. You can use very efficient enclosures to limit the amount of air volume in just a few racks. You can use in-row cooling, in-rack cooling, and really get the cooling to the equipment rather than cooling a huge air volume and hoping that air finds the servers that you're trying to manage. So I think facilities is sort of the second, and then just the smaller number of platforms is a big deal. And I think the third factor that comes in here is operating temperatures. I mean, it used to be that you needed to cool your data center to, you know, meat locker temperatures, and we're finding that that's really not the case at all. You can get away with data center temperatures that are 80 degrees, sometimes 90 degrees, depending on the quality of the servers that you're purchasing and deploying. So since you're not really cooling the air volume as much, you save a lot of energy there as well. So it's a combination of things that's not part of a grander plan, but just sort of all came together for us.
Happy accident. So what's the end game here? How dense do you think data centers will get? What will they look like 10 years from now?
Well, it's hard to say what it's going to look like 10 years from now, Alex, just because I don't think anybody really could have predicted what data centers would look like today 10 years ago.
Right.
We won't see data centers on the head of a pin, but I can pretty much guarantee you that the densities will continue to go up. And in the last decade, the effects have really been profound because we've had that combination of denser equipment, denser components,
mm-hmm.
And the effects of virtualization and the higher operating temperatures, and we're going to see the component densities continue to go up. You're going to see processors with more cores. You're going to see much denser memory, larger volumes of memory. So you're going to see, I think, the continued trend of fewer hardware platforms doing more work for your enterprise. But I think what you're going to really see is that trend will probably slow down in the years ahead. not so much from the component point of view, because I think that's always going to march forward, but I think we've done about all we can do with virtualization and just about all we can do with operating temperatures. So we've sort of reached the limits of some of those factors. So I think what we're going to see is a slower, more incremental increase in the densities of our data centers. And again, it's just been such an impressive decade. I've spoken with experts who've been speccing out data centers that just are using a single rack now that a few years ago would have taken thousands of square feet of equipment. And when you make that kind of a jump, the business case for it is sort of a slam dunk. And but to go from maybe one rack to a single appliance or even a a desktop data center, I don't know that the business case for that is as strong. So I think that tomorrow's improvements to data center densities are also going to be dependent on the business case and how strong that is. So,
well, to be continued. So we'll revisit this topic in a couple of years, see where we're at.
I'm looking forward to that.
Well, thanks for writing the piece, Steve. We really loved it.
Thanks, Alex.
It's great to catch up with Steve. He's our go-to data center, sort of physical data center person. So we're, so thanks again, Steve, for doing that and for coming in to talk to us. Make sure to check out the July-August issue. We're always at searchdatacenter.com/moderninfrastructure. Follow us on Twitter at Modern Infra, and we'll see you again in September. Thanks. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to Modern Infrastructure. To read the latest issue, visit searchdatacenter.com/moderninfrastructure.